Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
And I'm David Leopold, the Creative Director.
And we are back for episode number 49. What are we talking about today, David?
We are talking about something that we've talked about for a long time.
We're talking about stuff we've already talked about. No, that's
no,
not
no.
True.
We've talked about doing an episode on S.J. Perlman, Sweet By and By, and Westward Ha.
Yes.
And while this will, there are many S.J. Perlman stories, we are going to talk about just Sweet By and By and Westward Ha today.
Correct.
And because these are really sort of important moments, inflection points in both their careers.
Yes. And I think we should just briefly explain before we go any further. Sweet By and By is a musical Hirschfeld wrote with Perlman.
A flop musical comedy.
Well, we'll get to that.
Sure.
And Westward Ha, or Around the World in 80 Clichés, is a book that Perlman wrote and Hirschfeld illustrated.
Best-selling book.
And you will find out soon how these two things are linked together.
Crazy.
Yeah. Before we get too far into the episode, make sure to follow along in the show notes so you can see all the drawings we're talking about.
Well, I think we should, for those of you who don't know who S.J. Perlman is, Sidney J. Perlman was a very elaborately droll humorist whose humor was a defining element of The New Yorker when it started and
right.
for years. His stories in there and in many other publications. Hirschfeld told me that Sid got his start as a cartoonist and his captions started to get longer and longer until finally an editor says, why did you give up the drawings? Because the captions are where the fun is.
That's funny.
Yeah, it may even be true. But Hirschfeld thought that Perlman was the Picasso of literature. That was actually something he said to me. He said he dealt beautifully with the abstract. And he wrote stories for magazines. He had wanted to be a playwright. He wrote the first show he did on Broadway was he wrote the book for a musical review called Walk a Little Faster with Beatrice Lilly and Clark and McCullough. He wrote another play with his wife, Laura, called All Good Americans. None of these ran more than 6 months, and a lot of them ran for a lot less.
Right.
But in 1943, he wrote a musical comedy with Ogden Nash and Kurt Weill called One Touch of Venus. Sort of a Pygmalion-type story, or Galatea story, you know, where a statue comes to life. And, you know, the person kisses this sculpture, and it comes to life.
Ooh.
And the sculpture in question here was Mary Martin. And while that was trying out of town in...
Wait. It wasn't a statue of Mary Martin. Mary Martin played the lead role?
Yes.
Okay, I was imagining like, wow, that's wild. A statue, like that was the plot, was that there was a statue of Mary Martin that came to life.
Yeah.
Which would be a little odd, you must admit.
Yes, confusion. No, without a doubt.
Okay, the statue that came to life in the play was portrayed by Mary Martin.
Exactly.
Got it.
Exactly. So for those copy editors at home, I wouldn't have written it that way. It just came out that way. As Hirschfeld told me, he remembered meeting S.J. Perlman at a Benny Goodman rehearsal in New York in 1932. In the book Westward Ha, Perlman tells his side of the story, which happens a few months later in Paris, the same year. Hirschfeld would have been coming back from Bali, would have stopped in Paris. I don't think he had an exhibition of his work there. But he may have just been picking up and clearing out his studio in Paris because his 8-year lease was coming to an end.
Gotcha.
And I'm not sure he ever got back to that specific studio. Anyway, so as Perlman tells the story, he's sitting in a cafe in Paris and he sees a fashion writer, a woman that he knows, coming over to him with a bearded gentleman. And he is introduced. This is Hirschfeld. He draws caricatures for the New York Times. And immediately Perlman, the skinflint that he is, thinks, oh, he wants money.
Yeah, he basically panics.
I wouldn't say he panics, but he immediately starts speaking French. He says, no, me stony, no savvy. He says, plenty of bankruptcy around me. And Hirschfeld, as Perlman tells it, Hirschfeld's response is, it's free.
Right. He knew.
And immediately Perlman lets his guard down, gives him his good side. And as Perlman says, we were laughing and chatting. In 5 minutes, we were laughing and chatting like we had known each other for 5 minutes. So they get back to New York. They both get back to New York. And a few years later, it's 1943. Mm. Perlman is in Boston in an out-of-town tryout for One Touch of Venus. And Al Hirschfeld has found the love of his life, Dolly Haas. They get married. They're on the beach in Nantucket. For
honeymoon.
About an hour.
For their honeymoon.
They're there for about an hour when they both look at each other and realize they're very unhappy. They're not beach people. And they pack up and they go to a place where they are very comfortable, which is a dark theater. Mm. They go to see the out-of-town tryout. Hirschfeld's going to draw it. He makes his sketches. In fact, there are photographs that we have in the archive of him making sketches at the performance, at a town performance of One Touch of Venus.
And this is in Boston.
This is in Boston.
Of course, because they were in Nantucket. And...
sure. And, you know, of all, it's really a meeting of Hirschfeld's love life because one of the supporting players in One Touch of Venus is Paula Lawrence.
Of course.
Who was Hirschfeld's sort of main squeeze.
Yeah. For quite a long time.
In the 1930s. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
He separates from Flo, his first wife,
right,
when he comes home from Bali.
Right.
And then he sees Paula for most of the 1930s. Mm. And then he sees Dolly for the first time in 1941. Mm-hmm. And 2 years later, they're married.
Yeah.
So, and as I said, One Touch of Venus was a big hit.
Yeah.
And Perlman, when he's getting ready to work on his next show, because now he's a hit musical comedy book writer, he decides that Hirschfeld would be a perfect person to write with.
And so they've been friends since meeting in Paris. It wasn't like they met in Paris and then 11 years later they meet again.
I don't know exactly what their relationship was, okay, but what his friend said to me was that the only time they saw Sid sort of uncoil or relax was in Hirschfeld's presence, because Hirschfeld was a famously unflappable individual. You know, always cool as a cucumber, mm-hmm, and always ready with a quip. And Sid was neurotic. He was a very anxious guy. It informed his work. I mean, his work is sort of, he takes his anxieties and pushes it to 11.
He's Woody Allen's kind of inspiration. And yeah, it's that same vibe.
Yeah, very huge fan.
Yeah.
Woody stole liberally from S.J. Perlman. So they decide to write this musical comedy. As Hirschfeld says it, and he says this in American Theater, his book American Theater, he says, it all began with a telephone call from S.J. Perlman sometime in the 40s. He suggested we collaborate in the writing of a book for a musical. We met for lunch at the old Lafayette Hotel Cafe that same day. I don't remember what I ate at that luncheon, but 15 years have passed since then, and the gas pains are still with me. Perlman in Westward Ha tells his side of the story. He says, I've got an idea for a musical comedy, old man. Meet me at the Lafayette Coffee Rooms at 1 o'clock. Had Hirschfeld not met me at the Lafayette Coffee Rooms at 1 o'clock, this might never have been written. Mm. Another thing might never have been written if it gives 20 odd investors any solace. You know, he goes on to talk about, you know, Sweet By and By. Well, this was a show that they decided their premise for the show was the time capsule that was buried at the 1939 World's Fair. It's 2076, and they open up the time capsule, and I forget what the actual reason is, but there are shares of a candy company that go to what turns out to be a tree surgeon in Bryant Park, New York, and it makes him fabulously wealthy.
Wild.
It's a satire on American business and advertising. And it's written in the elaborate way that Perlman wrote. Mm. You know, he, as Hirschfeld says, he really dealt beautifully with the abstract, but he used the English language to do it.
Right.
And to read Perlman is to get a real sense of hearing what's in somebody's head.
Mm. You know, yes, it's very verbose.
Very verbose, but that's part of the comedy.
Yes.
You know, he's using language to really, he's taking advantage of language for all of its humor. And they had hoped to sort of reconstitute the team from One Touch of Venus. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
But Kurt Vile had other obligations, and he couldn't do it. And they went through a lot of different composers. They talked to a lot of different composers. They eventually settled on Vernon Duke, who Perlman must have known because Duke wrote the music to Perlman's first Broadway show. He wrote the book to Walk a Little Faster in 1932. So Vernon Duke was a remarkable composer in his own right. And of course, Ogden Nash was funny in a way that Perlman was funny. He really worked language, so he got all the humor out of it.
Gotcha.
And there are people of a certain age who can quote Ogden Nash. You know, he would write these little poems like, candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker.
I feel like I've heard that before.
Yes. Well, that's an Ogden Nash. There's a lot of great Ogden Nash. Gotcha. And if you have never read Ogden Nash, do yourself a favor. It's funny. So he was a perfect a lyricist to work on an S.J. Perlman show. And obviously it was successful because One Touch of Venus was. So they get the creative team together. They work on it. They had Cheryl Crawford, the great Cheryl Crawford, was originally going to produce it. And the process of going through it, eventually she gives up her option. Eventually a producer by the name of Nat Carson is the producer of it. And they decide they want to use an English actress by the name of Patricia Kirkwood in the lead. But she's shooting a movie out in Hollywood, so they wait. They wait about 3 or 4 months. And finally she's ready, and so they're very eager to get going. They start rehearsals like 2 or 3 weeks into it. She doesn't show up one day. Her mother calls and says she's under the weather. She's going to be in tomorrow. Next day, same thing. On the third day, the creative team decides to go over and see, you know, is she alive?
Right.
Yes, she was alive, but she wasn't at the hotel. She had gone to a sanitarium. She had had a nervous breakdown. She had been a ambulance driver during the war. And then she came to America, was put in some pretty lousy films. Her husband ran off with another woman, and she was just at the end of her rope.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. And then she's put into a musical comedy.
And knowing what I know now about this musical comedy did not help things.
Exactly.
Yeah, it could not have helped.
And if you're not going to go to Sid Perlman for sympathy.
No,
you know, he was not that kind of person. And I think Hirschfeld probably was, but he was in a group of people that she probably didn't go near the creatives.
I think of the Grow Up story.
Yes.
I've heard of Hirschfeld.
Yes, with March Champion.
Yes, yes.
So luckily, they were able to get Dolores Gray to fill in, and she was wonderful. Everybody agrees that she was wonderful. For the male lead, Al Hirschfeld and S.J. Perlman, both people who love vaudeville and burlesque, had decided that the male lead should be a fellow by the name of Gene Sheldon, who had a great banjo act in vaudeville. Why they thought he would be a good lead for a musical comedy on Broadway, I have no idea. But indeed, they hire him. And in a very famous scene in the world of Hirschfeld, when they go to opening night in New Haven, the out-of-town tryout in New Haven, in the first act, Gene Sheldon stops the show. He really steps out of character, and he starts to do his vaudeville routine.
And he's like a mime.
Yes. Sort of this mute banjo player who does this thing with his fingers, and it's crazy. He would have a success on TV, you know, early TV, because it was perfect for that. But he was not perfect for a Broadway-bound musical comedy. He does his act, which gets a lot of laughs. I mean, he had had years perfecting it. And when he comes off stage after the first act, Perlman is livid. I mean, he's screaming at him, like, what the hell are you doing out there? You know, and what makes you think you can do this? And
which is a fair question.
It is. No, no.
Totally, totally valid.
Yeah. And Hirschfeld told me the story. Sheldon replies, you hear those laughs out there? That was for my stuff, not for your stuff. Mm. At which point, Perlman decks him. Knocks him out.
Also valid, I think.
Hirschfeld told me very proudly, we were never brought up on charges at Equity. But they did have a issue for the second act.
Yes, that would present a big issue.
Their male lead now is unconscious backstage. The stage manager goes out, you know, he's on book, and they manage to get through the first performance, but it does not bode well. Mm. They don't know who they're going to get. An agent sells them on the idea. He's got a client, Eric Blore, who's going to be perfect for this, fast learner. Mm. He's going to really knock your socks off. I don't know why they believed that, but indeed they did. I guess beggars can't be choosers.
Yep,
you know, they've got the money there. They have to do it. Blore never learns the script.
No.
You know, for the rest of the tryout in New Haven and in Philadelphia, he cannot remember the script.
Wow.
So I can only imagine. Now, the show itself, the $400,000 that they spend on it, was not gone to waste.
$400,000.
In 1945, 46.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
And wow. Boris Aronson was the set designer.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah.
That does make sense. Of course he's the set designer. Who did the costumes?
Boris Aronson.
Who did the choreography?
Fred Kelly, Gene Kelly's brother.
Oh, yes. Yep, okay.
And
wow.
Aronson's conception of the set was a series of jigsaw pieces. Mm. And he wanted actually everything in plastic because he figured the future was going to be plastic.
He's not wrong.
Right. It in some ways, it's amazingly
very prescient.
Yeah. I mean, just... It was a beautiful set. We don't have any photographs. No photographs were ever taken of the set. But we have his set designs still exist.
Oh, sure.
And they're wonderful. But it was sort of, to paraphrase Alan M. McCleary about a show she was in, Miss Liberty, she said, it just goes to show how five geniuses can make a turkey.
Yeah.
Because you had all this incredible talent, and yet it was not coming together.
Right. It reminds me, it's like Swinging the Dream.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's like, why didn't this work out?
Yeah.
This should have been really, really great.
Well, it's like that on so many things. Statistics can tell you all kinds of things. You know, like in baseball, this guy should be the best pitcher in this situation.
right.
And then he throws the ball and the guy hits a home run.
Yeah. It happens.
Yeah, it happens. Bad luck. Star-crossed.
Yep.
They're in Philadelphia. Hirschfeld told me another story. He said they were working in the hotel room at the Hotel Warwick in Philadelphia on the show when Vernon Duke and Ogden Nash come in, and they had just been hanging out with some of Duke's friends. And he says, oh, Alan, Sid, you'll never believe it. I was talking to my friends, and they asked me if this show was a satire on American business and advertising. Isn't that a laugh? Yeah. That was not the reaction that Al Hirschfeld and Sid Perlman had.
Yeah, so they never really... Nash and...
Duke.
Nash and Duke never really understood the plot.
No.
I think they never got the book. Like, they never understood what this was.
Right.
So the music, it just never comes together.
Well, Hirschfeld would later say the fault in the show was no one knows what music of the future is going to be like.
I don't think that's what the problem was.
I think you had a very droll, satiric book. The songs are actually quite lovely.
Yeah.
PS Classics in 2011 recorded the score. They thought it was sort of the greatest musical comedy you've never heard of.
Mm.
And in fact, the songs are so good that Nash and Duke would reuse some of them for their next show, Two's Company.
Oh, interesting.
Which was a whole other disaster of another kind.
Maybe it was the music. Maybe it was. Maybe Hirschfeld was right.
Hirschfeld told me a week before they closed, he knew they were in trouble when he went to use the restroom. And in the restroom, Perlman was berating an actor about God damn it, don't you know how to be a space cowboy? As if everybody knew how to be a space cowboy.
You buffoon.
Yeah. So it wasn't looking good. I can only imagine what... Nobody wants to be associated with a failure. Let's face it.
No, of course not.
Nobody wants to waste $400,000 of other people's money.
A ton of money.
And they didn't know what was going to happen next. Yeah, it was going to be pretty... This show was not coming into New York.
Whatever was going to come was not going to be good.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then fate stepped in. Ted Patrick of Holiday Magazine. Holiday Magazine was this very luxurious, oversized magazine that hired top writers to go around the world with photographers and write stories about different places you could travel to on your holiday.
Lovely.
Yes. A great thing that was very successful in its day.
Oh, I'm sure.
And
they're very beautiful magazines if you ever see one. They're very large, oversized, right. And yeah, full color, beautiful.
And the magazine has been reconstituted and restarted, but it's not. It's more fashion and things to buy. And whereas the original Holiday, which was published by Curtis Publishing, which was based in Philadelphia, which is why Ted Patrick was in Philadelphia.
Gotcha.
And so he runs into Perlman and let's have lunch.
Mm.
So Perlman, Patrick, and Hirschfeld go out to lunch. And they, you know, although in Westward Ha, Perlman says he told them that they had a flop, I don't think that he knew they had a flop. And when Hirschfeld told me the story, it was clear that they were just sort of vamping, like, what are you going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Patrick asks Perlman, what are you going to do next? He says, oh, you know, when this show opens on Broadway, I might go sword fishing in Florida.
Yeah.
And Patrick's like, well, maybe you could do a story for us there. And Perlman's like, well, maybe I would do it, but you'd have to include Hirschfeld to do the drawings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Patrick's not against that. And Hirschfeld is like, wait a second, fellas. I haven't seen my wife for 9 months. She's been on the road with Lutesong and with their
toddler,
like 9 month baby, Nina, who Hirschfeld told me that at one point during the tour, Nina saw a picture of a gorilla and said, Daddy. And he knew it was time to get
time
back to
go
his
home.
Family.
Yeah.
So he said, whatever your plans are, count me out. I'm going to Hollywood, which is where Lutesong was at that time. Well, then Ted Patrick says, well, would you fellows like to do a story about the colorful natives of Hollywood?
Mm.
And I don't know how the conversation gets going, but Hirschfeld suggests that they send Perlman to Tahiti because... You know, Tahiti was this very inauthentic culture. In fact, in Westward Ha, he describes Tahiti, it's just like Washington Heights. It's full of beat-up ukulele players and cheap grifters. They've got a Whalen drugstore on every block. So he saw it as an inauthentic culture.
Yeah.
And he knew that Perlman would have a field day with something like that. Well, that leads to conversations about Bali. And, of course, Hirschfeld waxing rhapsodic about Bali. It's not that long after it. It's 12 years, 13 years after he's returned. And it's, you know, the discovery he makes in Bali is still very much part of his life.
Sure.
Well, as Hirschfeld says, after a lot more insanely logical conversation and a few martinis, Patrick offers them, you know, ask them if they'd go around the world.
Mm.
And this is what Perlman says in Westward Ha. He says, when a man you scarcely know suggests a trip lasting 9 months and covering 27 countries, you're justified in leaping to one of four assumptions. First, that he is an imposter. Second, that he is hopelessly in love with your wife and will go to any lengths to get you out of the country. Third, that you have blundered by mistake into an Alfred Hitchcock film. And fourth, that you have succumbed to a combination of ennui, wanderlust, paranoia, and brandy. And nevertheless, they both agree to do it.
Mm.
And I mean, it's a lifeline to them. They have a flop musical that they are just they're not interested in returning to New York.
Right. But they are ready to get away from this. They're ready to do something else.
They're ready to
distract everybody with something else.
And so they agree to do this. They have the last week. This is October 1946. Mm. They spend one more week in Philadelphia with this flop show. And then they sneak back into New York. They make a contract with Simon & Schuster to publish a book of the articles that they write on this trip.
Mm.
And then they leave. They go away for 9 months. It's the longest time that Hirschfeld is away from Broadway during his entire career.
Wow. Even because he was in Bali for 8 months?
He was in Bali for 8 months. That is true.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a part of the scene in the same way.
Sure. Yes. He was just starting in 1931, 1932.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
By 1947, when they took this trip.
Well, he was exclusive with the Times.
He was already exclusive with the Times. His work was essentially already the logo of American theater.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
And this trip is why we do not have a drawing. A contemporaneous drawing of the original production of Streetcar Named Desire.
Wow.
It's why we don't have a drawing of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Allegro or Finian's Rainbow. It's amazing. The shows that he missed in one season that we don't have. I mean, classics.
Yeah.
Not just any shows. These are classics.
Right. That we don't have, like you said, a contemporaneous. Yes, there are retrospective drawings of Streetcar and other productions of Streetcar, but not the original Broadway production.
That's right. And, I mean, so it's a big thing. And they go out to Hollywood, which, of course, is perfect material for Perlman to write about.
He's
a very cynical.
Yes, and I don't think he enjoyed his time in Hollywood.
No, and it was very fashionable for writers from the East to go out to Hollywood and have a terrible time. As early as 1930, in the comedy Once in a Lifetime, George Kaufman, you know, which was written by George Kaufman and Moss Hart, George Kaufman plays a playwright from the East who goes out to Hollywood and has a series of terrible experiences. And it's very funny, and everybody understood what that was.
I wonder if that's self-biographical.
Yeah.
Or autobiographical.
No, it actually wasn't.
Oh, Kaufman, really?
Early on in his career, realized that he was going to write the plays. If they were going to make movies of the plays, that was somebody else's business.
And that's fair.
And he felt that if he didn't have anything to do with it, he couldn't be blamed by it.
I think that's a good take.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
I mean, he would go out, you know, he was a co-writer of the script of the Marx Brothers' Night at the Opera.
Right.
And, of course, Animal Crackers, which had been a stage show. But for the most part, he stayed away from Hollywood.
Yeah. And, of course, Perlman wrote for the Marx Brothers as well.
Right. So Perlman had written for two Marx Brothers films in the 1930s for Paramount, and he had written other works in Hollywood, so he knew the world pretty well. Hirschfeld goes out there, he takes his movie camera, he films all these crazy things in Hollywood, like a place that sold hamburgers and hot dogs, and it was called Hammenfurters, and you know, all these crazy, buildings and restaurants that are in the shape of whatever the Brown Derby or
weird stuff in Hollywood. The Hollywood folk are doing.
He told me later he showed the movie to Saul Steinberg, the cartoonist, and Steinberg did a whole series based on this film.
Oh, wow.
Without crediting Hirschfeld.
And if you don't know, Hirschfeld was a really big home movie buff.
Yeah.
He was an early adopter. And loved to not only take pictures, but specifically video.
As far back, he didn't take it to Moscow in 28. But,
can you imagine?
Yeah. I think about that sometimes.
Oh.
But he does take it to Bali.
Mm.
And he films dances and whatnot. It's really great ethnographic filmmaking.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. So he took all these films. He uses some of the things that he saw in his own drawings of Hollywood at the beginning of Westward Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say this right now. If you have not read Westward Ha, maybe pause the podcast and go do it right now. It's totally worth it. Or you should
at
read
least
it after this.
At least pause and go, you know, buy a copy. Yeah. I'm looking here on Amazon. You can get a paperback, used, of course, $11. So it is not a big expense. You can find, you know, affordable. This is not in print, okay? Yeah. So you're going to have to get a used copy, but it's very affordable. This is not a rare book. No. You know, you're not going to be paying top dollar. You can get it.
And lots of people think it's funny, not just people here at the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. Yeah. I remember once I interviewed Stanley Tucci for a movie he did, Joe Gold's Secret.
It all comes back to Joe
Gold. Yeah, of course.
Always.
And at the end of the interview, I said to him, would you like to meet somebody who knew Joe Gold?
Oh.
And he said, sure, who's that? I said, Al Hirschfeld. And I said, why don't you come up to the studio? And I then called Hirschfeld. I said, do you mind if I bring Stanley Tucci up to the studio?
Then you asked for permission.
I knew that Hirschfeld would be game for it. I'd known him pretty well. And when Stanley Tucci comes up, he's a total fan. And we're up in the studio and he's like, Mr. Hirschfeld, would you mind if, could I ask for your autograph? And of course, Hirschfeld was, sure. Mm-hmm. And what does he pull out? A copy of Westward Ho.
Oh, you know, nice.
So we're not the only ones who think this is a very funny book.
Hirschfeld thinks it's funny too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's basically what the moral of the story is. See, I love the podcast because I've never heard that Stanley Tucci story.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes, you know, because why would that have come up ever? Why that little detail? But it's a fun
I'm not a name popper.
Yeah. It's a funny little story. So thank you.
And you might wonder why Perlman would pick Hirschfeld. You know, you can have a good friend, but, you know.
Yeah. I don't know if I would travel around the world with you for 9 months. I don't know.
I definitely wouldn't do it. I value my sanity. When I was 16 years old, I was on tour with the Grateful Dead.
Mm.
And my brother and I were traveling with a couple. And they had a pickup truck. We were in the back with another couple and they were in the front. And we had stopped to get gas. And the couple who were driving were having an argument.
Mm.
And so we're stopping at gas, we're getting food and whatnot. And there's this old man there, and he sees this couple having an argument, and he calls my brother John and I over, and he says, listen, boys, if you want to marry a girl, don't live with her for a year. Travel with her for 2 weeks, and if you can deal with that, you're going to be fine.
That's good advice, probably.
Very good advice.
Yeah.
And so Perlman and Hirschfeld were close enough that
they thought their relationship would survive 9 months around the world. All right.
And this is how, you know, Hirschfeld had sort of, as Perlman said, done the giant swing before.
Mm-hmm.
He had not actually gone around the world, but he had been to a lot of places in the world. He'd been to North Africa. He'd already been in Bali.
Russia.
He had been all throughout Europe. You know, he'd been to Mexico. You know, he'd been a lot of places.
Yeah.
And he said, was unquestionably the ideal person to share my stateroom and illustrate our experiences. Besides, I needed someone to protect me from whatever sultry womanhood, bloodthirsty brigands, and cavernous fauna lay in wait. His qualifications were obvious. A pair of liquid brown eyes, delicately rimmed in red, of an innocence to charm the heart of the fiercest aborigine, and a beard that would engulf anything from a tsetse fly to a Sumatra tiger. In short, a remarkable combination of Walt Whitman, Lawrence of Arabia, and Mo, my favorite waiter at Lindy's. So they're in Hollywood. Hirschfeld is reunited with his family. Strangely enough, he reunites with them long enough to say goodbye. He's leaving again.
Hello, I must be going.
Yes.
And speaking of.
Yes. Very funny you should mention that, because there's a farewell dinner that is held at Chazen's restaurant for Perlman and Hirschfeld.
Mm.
And who gives the farewell send-off?
Groucho Marx.
As a rule, I don't waste my valuable time attending banquets. The only dinners I attended last year were the Academy Award dinner, the dinner that Basil Rathbone gave for Mrs. Rathbone, the dinner the railroad men gave for Choo Choo Johnson honoring Choo Choo Martinez, and the dinner that Mrs. Rathbone gave for Basil Rathbone. Other than getting a meal on the cuff, I don't much see the point to a public banquet. I assure you that there are more edifying sights than a group of elderly men stuffing themselves with free food tossed at them by an obscure magazine of doubtful literary distinction. So Hirschfeld and Perelman are leaving the country. I can just imagine the furor this will cause throughout the civilized world. After all, other men have scrammed for parts unknown. Abe Hummel left the country, Judge Crater has never been found, and Dory Sherry finally landed at RKO. I don't know Mr. Hirschfeld except by reputation. The last time I heard him, he appeared with Lee Francis on Can You Top This? But Sid and I go back a long ways. I remember him when he started with Judge Magazine. He was an instant success, for he was the face writer that had stole all the jokes from Whizbang. I remember Sid as a farmer when he was too poor to buy fertilizer and kept his crops healthy by using the New York Daily News instead. A boat trip can be tragic if two people aren't compatible, but I'm sure that Sid and Al will get along swimmingly. Sid is a lovable companion and a born diplomat. I might say he's as comfortable to be with as an old glove, and just about as interesting. I remember once years ago, he and I went to Jersey City by ferry, and by the time the boat got to Canal Street, he had kicked the bootblack in the groin because he had charged him 10 cents for a shine. There will be times in far-off places, Mr. Hirschfeld, when you will be unable to get porters for your baggage. But with Sid at your side, you can rest easy. Sid is a thumping big fellow and a workhorse to boot, and he gets a kick out of lifting heavy things. I remember the time he was arrested for lifting a fur coat at Saks Fifth Avenue. I'm sure that Sid and General MacArthur will have some high old times together in Tokyo. I can see them at night, warming themselves over a geisha girl and chuckling over the old days when MacArthur used to shoot at Sid's relatives from the White House steps. This trip will do President Truman a lot of good, for you must remember, it is under his administration that the boys are leaving the country. This is one thing the Republicans won't be able to take credit for. I want to wish you two a successful and happy journey. Come back to America safe and strong, for America needs you. A country is only as strong as its weakest link. It is only lads like you that can supply that. So I say to you, two bold adventurers, stretch out your hands for the fruits of the world. Bring back tales of African veldt, of the snows of Kilimanjaro, of the Romanian peasants plowing the furrows and chanting the songs of Boris Moros. Tell us more of the Dutch boy with his finger in the dike, and if possible, bring back a dike to each of us. Live dangerously, my friends. Have yourselves a brawl in Singapore, or go on a bust in Bali. Nab the world by the tail. There is plenty of it around if you keep your eyes peeled. As for your book, I'm sure will be a huge success. I know that I, for one, will be standing in line to grab a copy as soon as it reaches the Lendy Library. I know that predictions can be dangerous, but I want to go on record as saying that someday the book of Perelman and Hirschfeld will take its place alongside Dombey and Son, John Drinkwater's Life of Carl Laemmle, and Mexican Hayride. Groucho Marx, January 15th, 1947, Chasen's Restaurant. Unpublished, for good reason.
So they take off in Westward Ha. Perelman talks about, oh, they're going to go to this place or that place. Well, it turns out there's not a boat there for 3 months, and they'd have to wait a month to the next. They realize that they can go around the world, but they can't take the rest of their lives to do
right.
It.
The global economy was not there yet.
Exactly. And they were also a little bit hamstrung in their transportation choices because Hirschfeld had last taken a plane flight in 1928.
Oh, I don't know this story.
Oh, yeah. He took a plane flight to Beirut with gold. I'd have to check my notes. Yeah. Like they were trying to avoid bandits.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he told me there was something in the New York Times. I've never found it.
Oh.
But it's a crazy story. But soon he learns from a doctor that if he continues to fly, he had something in his inner ear, and that if he continued to fly, he might go deaf.
Oh. So, I always thought it, like, hurt him. I always thought he had sensitive ears. And
that's why he went to the doctor to say, I had this feeling.
I always just thought like he preferred not to fly because it was something with his equilibrium.
No, it was a doctor had told him that he was losing his hearing.
Fascinating.
And so Hirschfeld, for the rest of his life,
did not fly.
He didn't take planes, but he took trains and automobiles and ships.
Mm-hmm.
The crazy thing about this is, so Hirschfeld is this very cool character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't upset him. You can't, you know, in all the years that I knew him, I only heard him raise his voice once, and it was totally justified.
Mm.
But Perelman was a guy who was chronically impatient.
Yeah.
So they start off on a ship.
Yes.
And he tells some wonderful stories about their maiden voyage. but soon, once they start traveling, Perlman can't take all this time on ships.
Can't take the downtime.
Yeah, there's, you know, he's got to get going, and so oftentimes Perlman would fly to someplace like Singapore, mm-hmm. and Hirschfeld would go by hook or crook to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, take a ship and then wagon
from
or
this
something.
Port to
And of course, it being Hirschfeld, he'd already met a half dozen people who were fascinating.
And he's having a great time. Yeah, he's like in no rush to get to Singapore to see Perlman.
He's taking it all in and loving it. And he gets to wherever they're at, and Perlman's ready to go.
Right. He's already been there for a few days.
Right,
he's ready to move on.
Exactly.
That's so funny.
So they never go to Bali.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, which we always think is for the best.
Yes.
Because... gosh, wouldn't it have been horrible if he went back and it was already so changed and he hated it? You know, it's like you got to keep that memory, you know, don't go back. Just keep it as it is and cherish it.
Yeah, it's Brigadoon in that sense.
Yeah.
You know, it lasted for one moment and that's what it is.
Yeah. I always think it's for the best.
But they go through Singapore. They're in Asia.
Yep.
They end up going through different parts in France.
Yeah.
Well, Europe, I'm sorry.
Well, speaking of East Asia, though, I want to touch briefly on the time they spent in Siam, now Thailand, and the home videos.
Yeah.
There. Well,
they weren't called home videos at that time.
What were they called?
Home movies.
Home movies. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, video was a word. I mean, it was a real word, but people didn't use it.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, the home movies.
As you've probably heard on this podcast before, they did go to Siam. Hirschfeld did some wonderful drawings there for the Perlman pieces. And remember, so they would go to Siam, mm-hmm. spend a couple of days there. Perlman would he would make his notes and then he would write.
Right.
And Hirschfeld would do drawings while on the road. They would send it back to Holiday for that month's issue.
Right.
They were gone for 9 months. That was 9 articles.
Yeah. So it was a periodical.
Yeah. It was a monthly magazine, and so they had a deadline. So that, you know, they
are not a periodical. What's the word I'm thinking of?
Well, periodical
is it?
Correct.
Oh,
yeah. The period happens to be 1 month. so that, you know, they're both people who are serious, have a serious work ethic. You know, as much fun as they were having, crazy adventures that they were having, they also knew that they had to supply the words and the pictures.
It wasn't a vacation.
It wasn't a vacation. And it's one of the few times we have Hirschfeld drawings on paper rather than board.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know why, if that is because it was easier to send or cheaper to send.
Yeah.
It's really, in fact, it's the first drawing of that series, one of the first drawings, the cultural evening with the first mate and... And the engineer or something.
On the ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That drawing's on paper, and I wonder if it's because they had to sort of ship it not while at sea, but...
But maybe it was in a... You could put it in a tube?
Right.
I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know.
Is it easier? It's probably... I mean, I know, just based on the Hirschfeld drawings I deal with every day, I know it's a lot heavier to carry around boards than it is, you know, pieces of paper.
But most of the other drawings are done on boards.
Yeah.
They're done on smaller boards.
Yeah, they're very small drawings. Yes,
But they're also a different kind of drawing.
Yes.
I mean, this is what's interesting about this. This is his books with S.J. Perlman. He would do 3 of them. And, of course, also illustrate a number of articles. He's illustrating what Perlman is writing, not necessarily
what is
from
happening.
Life.
Yeah.
I mean, he had his own experiences, but
Sid says this thing, he'll, like, if he saw it this way, he will, you know, Hirschfeld will draw it the way Sid saw it.
Now, what is very fascinating, at least it was to me, is years ago I was at the New York Public Library in their, I forget what their literature department is, you know, that mm-hmm. has objects, but they have Perlman's suitcase. From that trip.
What?
And they have the diary he kept from this trip. It's in a little spiral bound notebook. And I thought, well, I should look at this. I didn't read the whole thing, but I thought this might give me some background information on Westward Ha. And the thing that stuck out to me, you've heard me say it before, he's describing some places being really, really boring. And he said it's like a rainy Sunday night in Rochester or any night in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I thought to myself, how does he know?
How does he know? Because he went there.
Yeah.
Because he's been to Harrisburg.
I felt so bad for S.J. Perlman at that moment. I didn't have a choice. He did.
Yeah. But, well, let's get back to Siam.
Yeah. So they're in Siam. They get invited by the court of Siam to come see some dances. Ooh. And Hirschfeld, being Hirschfeld, brings his movie camera along with him. And he asks if he could take some home movies. They agree. Not really many people had done that before, but sure. And so Hirschfeld takes film of these dances in Siam. Mm. And when they eventually return, not right away, but he soon hears that Rodgers and Hammerstein are working on a musical about Siam.
Wild.
So he calls them up and says, I have this, you know, would you like to see dances from Siam? Now, of course, these would have been silent. There was no sound.
Yeah.
And they do. And I believe they come up with Jerry Robbins.
Wow.
And I'm not going to say, what is it? The House of Uncle Thomas?
Oh, yeah. Small House of Uncle Thomas.
The Small House of Uncle Thomas is based on Hirschfeld's film.
Oh.
But I think what he showed them informed what Jerry Robbins was
certainly
doing.
It had to have.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
So, he might be away from Broadway, but Broadway is not away from him.
Do we have that? Do we have the Siam video? Excuse me, movie?
We are still in the process of cataloging all the videos.
I know we have a lot of home
movies. We do have
movies.
Footage from I know we have footage from the Westward Ha trip.
I was just wondering because I've never seen it. And I was like, oh, I wonder if we have it.
We should take a look.
Yeah, we should.
And that would be a wonderful addition to put out there. Maybe a short Hirschfeld moment film.
Ooh.
Stay tuned, everybody.
Well, I love that story. I think it's so neat.
And it's all part of their experiences.
Yeah.
When they're in Europe, they eventually see the performer Hermione Gingold.
Yes.
And they think she's great.
Yeah.
You know, she is not someone you want to spend a lot of time looking at, but she was compelling.
Yeah.
And they loved all of her eccentricities. Mm. And in fact, Hermione Gingold loved Hirschfeld back because when she writes her memoir, she has Hirschfeld do the cover.
Aw, nice.
The trip takes them. And of course, it's not a Perlman book unless Perlman is complaining.
I mean,
because that's what you
it's
come
kind of
for.
The thing.
That's
yeah.
where the humor comes from. And throughout it, Hirschfeld is this sort of guy who always has his head on his shoulders while Perlman is freaking out. You know. But even they go through so many weird and wonderful experiences that as the 9 months are coming to an end, they realize that this was probably more than they needed.
Mm.
And near the end of the book, Perlman writes, he claims he's quoting Hirschfeld, although I'm pretty confident this was not an actual quote. He says, listen, he said, weighing every word, this is a promise. This is Hirschfeld talking. This is a promise. If I ever get home again, I'm going to take every suitcase I own and burn it to ashes. Then I'm going to take a hammer and beat the ashes so that no can make a suitcase out of them ever again. Promise me one more thing, Perlman said. Don't throw away the hammer. Why? Because, I said with equal deliberation, if I ever suggest, if I ever so much as hint at a trip anywhere, even Jersey City, I want you to take that hammer and beat me to a powder. Hirschfeld arose and extended his hand, his eyes shining. Old man, he said emotionally, it'll be a pleasure.
That's good.
And that is just, I could read the whole book and it would be phenomenal.
Yes.
I'm not going to,
no.
Obviously. But it gives you some sense of this. Now, there is a sort of aftermath. Hirschfeld is living in a converted storage shed on top of the Osborne.
Oh, that's
on
right.
On 57th Street.
I forgot about that.
But with the money he made from Holiday Magazine and Simon & Schuster, especially when the book becomes a bestseller, Hirschfeld has enough money that he says that he felt better about capitalism because any system that was so benevolently conceived that he could make money couldn't be all bad.
That's so funny because you could also interpret it as it could be all bad. Like,
yeah.
I can make this much money off of, you know, this poor stuff I've done.
Yeah.
And
well, so he ends up, he says the money I made from these allowed me to buy a house in the 90s and start living there in the 50s.
That's funny. So this is when he buys his home on East 95th Street.
Yes.
Oh.
And the home he would have for the rest of his life.
Yes. His forever home.
And for Perlman, the success of Westward Ho, he had a number of other books before, they were all collections of pieces. In fact, while the same month that Sweet By and By is closing in Philadelphia, October 1946, there is a story by Perlman in Red Book that is literally a scene from the play.
Mm.
And Hirschfeld does, it's in Listen to the Mockingbird, and the drawing shows these two robots talking to each other because it's a story. The humor of the story is these two robots have feelings, you know, and of course they're robots. It's crazy. Mm. It's all too on the nose right now.
It's all
now.
Too real, yeah.
You think AI is a new problem.
Yeah. Jeez.
But Perlman had always wanted to write a novel, and he was only known as a short story writer. But now these pieces were all sequential.
Right.
They told a whole story. And,
yeah.
And Hirschfeld said.
You did it.
You did it. You can do this.
Yeah.
And he was really excited because he figured Perlman would write a novel.
Mm.
He never did.
Mm.
I don't think he could really sort of ever scale the heights.
Mm.
He had one more book a little bit like this called Acres and Pains, which I think came out after this. This was about his farm in Bucks County.
Oh, okay.
And the stories, while they were all dealing with the same thing, they weren't sequential in the way that Westward Ho is.
Yeah. What about Swiss Family Perlman?
Well, that's another story, again, that was done as a series of articles.
I see.
That's the most he would ever do.
I see. Sure.
He can never actually go the last mile
and
write the novel from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame because his work is really, I think, very, very funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be for all markets what comedy is.
No.
But Westward Ho is a real classic, a comedy classic. And I don't think you could film it or perform it in any other way because it is definitely a piece of literature.
Mm.
And augmented by these wonderful Hirschfeld drawings that are, of course, done in Hirschfeld style, but they're different than the work he does for Broadway or even the movies.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that earlier when we were talking about Siam, but the Perlman, you know, kind of our lingo in the office here, what we call the Perlman pieces, there is a certain group of characteristics that come to mind when we say Perlman pieces. And they're much smaller drawings,
right.
Sometimes on paper, as you said, but usually on board, though,
right.
But quite small. Maybe like, what would you say, 12 by 18?
Yeah.
Like something like that. Like
instead of his normal board size, which was up to 22 by 30.
Right, right. And they're usually much more detailed. They're usually showing quite a bit of action. You know, like they're always buzzing by somewhere. You know, they're always whipping around a corner or going down a hill.
I think they're much more like comic art.
Yeah, they're very active.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
They're active and they're intended to be funny, whereas I think so much of his other work is witty without necessarily being comic.
Yeah, and we'll think about it this way. We always say the theater work, or, you know, the theater work, the film work, it's documentary.
Right.
And this is not that. As you said, he's actually bringing to life Perlman's experiences rather than actually documenting the action of what actually happened.
Right.
So it is different. They feel different because they are different from the rest of his work, I think.
But Westward Ho also has these detailed drawings of downtown Singapore.
Yes, yes. Or the other places like that. The Siamese sketchbook.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. Like all of those, very detailed and I'm sure very accurate portrayal of, you know, certain things. But right. Yeah, if Perlman's in the scene, you never know.
Yeah.
And who knows?
He reduces Perlman to a few lines that we all recognize as Perlman.
Yeah.
And looks amazingly like him, even though
like him.
I mean, it's really, if you look at it closely, there's not much there.
Yeah. No, there's not. He's usually in sunglasses. Like, he's got sunglasses or big glasses on, and
And he also, there's a lot of self-portraits in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't pull punches on himself. He shows himself as ridiculous as anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, there's a drawing of the two of them. They're on a ship, and the captain's wife is this beautiful woman.
Oh, yeah.
And she's sort of standing at the guardrail there, and every man on the boat is looking at her, and you know, Hirschfeld's eyes are practically bulging out of his head.
Yes, the biggest you've ever seen Hirschfeld's eyes. But yeah, I just wanted to. Well, I guess I don't have anything to say. I just wanted to say our experience. You know, people don't get that the Perlman pieces are different.
Yes. Oh, without a doubt, and. You know, we were just saying about how you travel with somebody for that long a time. Maybe that's the last person you want to see.
Right.
When you get home.
They were still friends after.
They not only were friends, they still look for opportunities to
work together. Oh, geez.
Soon after they got back, Holiday did a special issue on New York.
Mm.
And Perlman writes this piece, Long Time No Sightsee.
Oh, that's a classic in The Office.
And so you see Hirschfeld and Perlman in the lobby of Radio City Music Hall and places like that. Eventually go to the Kentucky Derby together.
Yes, I remember that one.
I mean, it's wild. Weird. I mean, it is a really strong friendship, although Perlman was not a person who made friends easily.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of an odd couple situation.
Yes.
You know, Hirschfeld keeps him calm. You know, Hirschfeld's able to talk to the police if he needs, whatever it is. Like, he's the one that's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And Perlman's the neurotic one. And, you know, so it kind of works out that way, I think. They're a good match.
We have it in, we still have it. Maybe it's over at the library now.
Mm.
A postcard. Years later, this is probably in the early 70s, Perlman is in some place, and he sends back a postcard of a guy with a white beard. And
we do have this. Yeah.
Yeah. He says, and he writes to Alan Dolly. He's like, well, it turns out this man says he's the one who draws all the caricatures from the New York Times. I mean, it goes on for a whole postcard, keeping the thing. And I'm sure it was sent around the world just to get a snicker out of Hirschfeld.
Yeah.
But that's what they did.
Just for the
gag. They were constantly, they made each other laugh, which I think was a very important part of their friendship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, and Hirschfeld genuinely liked Perlman and his family, he was obviously closest to Sid.
Mm-hmm.
He kept a drawing of Perlman at the top of his stairs, really outside of his bedroom, believe it or not. You went to the top of the stairs and it was that wonderful drawing of Perlman reclining. That was done, I think, in 1970.
Wow. That's an iconic, at least for me, that's like an iconic Hirschfeld drawing of Perlman. Yeah.
Definitely.
Such a good one.
And the two of them would become so closely associated that when Perlman did articles for other magazines, I don't know whether it was an art director or Perlman said, you should get Hirschfeld.
Right.
But when he does his Eastward Ha series for Travel and Leisure.
Oh, those drawings. Oh.
Yeah. But strangely, when the book comes out, none of the drawings are included.
Yeah. But they were in the magazine.
Yeah. But when Perlman writes for TV Guide.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. The Elizabeth Taylor and
Or when Perlman writes op-ed pieces for the New York Times, they are also illustrated.
Is that like the Big Ben?
Big Ben.
Parliament, yeah.
Trafalgar Square and things like that. Because Perlman would move to London after his wife died. He sold the home in Bucks County and moved to London.
Oh, I didn't know that.
it would turn out to be a big mistake for him. Mm. You know, he was not happy and sort of tried to reconstitute his life before, but it never could work. You know, his wife was an important part of who he was. Aww. But this is not an S.J. Perlman podcast. Yes. This is a
we don't know.
Sweet by and by.
And Westward Ha.
Westward Ha.
Yeah.
And as I said, if you want to hear the score, P.S. Classics did a wonderful recording of the score in 2011. And you should definitely check
that it's in. On Spotify. Mm. I listened to it over the weekend.
There you go.
It's wild.
If you,
it's worth a listen because it is wild. But the music, you're right. The music is good. It's not that it's bad music.
No.
It's just the plot's really weird.
Yeah, it is really weird.
Yeah.
And it's quite obvious why it was not a hit.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Or even good
but it's
enough
worth,
to go
in. It's worth listening to because it's funny.
Perlman wrote a little author bio that appeared, like, you know, just a few lines. Mm-hmm. And he described himself as someone who owned a farm in Bucks County where he raised turkeys that he showed on Broadway.
That's funny.
Perlman was a funny person.
Yes, yes.
So now this is episode 49. You know what that comes, you know what happens after that.
What happens after episode
49? The 50th episode.
Yes.
So tell us what the 50th.
Well, the 50th episode, we want to answer your Hirschfeld questions. Your Hirschfeld or David and Catherine questions or, you know, Al Hirschfeld Foundation questions. We love getting questions. We love teaching you new things and telling stories you haven't heard before.
Yes.
Or looking for opinions. Whatever it is, this is an AMA for the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. We want you to send in your questions that you have for us so we can answer them in our 50th episode.
Right. And we'll have some highlights from previous episodes.
Because I think it's been 7 years since we started the podcast, which is a long time to get to 50 episodes. But we're recording much more regularly now.
We have something that we didn't have 7 years ago.
That's also true. Our wonderful media director, Doug Koons.
Right. He really cracks a hard whip.
Yes. And yes. So things really improved after Doug came along here.
We keep on a schedule now.
Yes. Yes.
And hopefully we sound better than we've ever done.
I think we do.
Yeah.
So we want to do that for the 50th episode. Right. And like so my point, I guess, of saying that was we've told a lot of stories, but some of them were quite a long time ago.
Right.
So maybe you've forgotten and you have, you know, we're happy to answer questions we've already answered as well.
Right.
But send those in to info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org. You can also, that is definitely the best way, put like, you know, Hirschfeld AMA or whatever in the subject line. You can also reach out on our socials, though, like I said, it would be easier if you emailed, but Instagram at Al Hirschfeld, Facebook, Al Hirschfeld Foundation, Twitter, Al Hirschfeld. So write us in your Hirschfeld questions, whatever they are. What Definitely. Kind of pen did he use? Whatever was nearby.
Carefully guarded secret. We can't reveal that.
It's not. It's actually nothing. It's actually quite boring. Don't ask that question because the answer is actually not that interesting. It's just a pen.
He's the triumph of the ordinary, I guess.
So anyway, we'd like you to do that. We want to hear from you.
You can always go to our website at alhirschfeldfoundation.org. And there's a contact form there. You can send us
That's
a message
also true.
Right there.
That's also true. So send us your questions.
Check out our shop, our online shop.
Oh, yeah. A very special thank you to Frank Ferrante, a leading interpreter of Groucho Marx, of course, for reading Groucho's send-off speech he gave in January 1947, preparing to send Hirschfeld and Perlman around the world in 80 cliches.
Thank you very much for listening. And we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.